Steve Piatz joins me this week to discuss making the perfect session mead. This is Beersmith Podcast number 175.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 175, and it's early August 2018. This week, Steve Piatz joins me to discuss crafting session meads. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They have a new Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine podcast, which I encourage you to check out. It features some of the top craft brewery owners and brewmasters discussing brewing techniques and their flavors in beer. It's the podcast for those who make and drink great beer. You can find it on iTunes or at beerandbrewing.com/podcasts. And also the BrewVision thermometer from Blickman Engineering. This interactive wireless digital thermometer connects right to your iPhone or iPad and lets you remotely monitor and record temperatures. You can download recipes right from the Beersmith cloud and send updates and alerts as you brew. Get the BrewVision Bluetooth thermometer today. Another great innovation from BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, Beersmith 3 is available now for download. Beersmith 3 adds mead, wine, and cider recipe support to the Beersmith software platform, along with new integrated water profile and mash pH tools. There's dozens of new features, including cloud folders, updated databases, support for fruit, juice, and honey, as well as new Whirlpool hop options. Download your free 21-day trade trial of Beersmith 3 today from beersmith.com. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome back Steve Piatz. Steve is author of the book, The Complete Guide to Mead Making. He was also the 2008 Mead Maker of the Year, and he's a longtime mead maker and judge. Steve, it's great to have you back on the show. I think this is your second time, right?
Yep. Good to chat, Brad.
So what have you been up to this last year plus, I guess, since I saw you last?
Quite a few international trips, actually, judging beers and meads, mostly Latin America. It's kind of interesting. It's a hotbed of activity these days, it seems like.
Really? Is there a lot of mead making going on down there? I know the beer scene is exploding right now in South America.
The beer scene is really exploding, and there's getting to be a lot of interest in mead. There aren't a lot of people making it yet. The information's a little hard to come by, as are some of the ingredients. But I am doing a 2-day workshop on mead making in Santiago, Chile in August.
No kidding. That's really cool.
Yeah.
So today you want to discuss session meads. Let's start by defining what a session mead is. I actually make big, giant, heavy meads, so I'm not that familiar with session meads, actually.
I don't make a lot of smaller meads either. I'm kind of a sack strength guy for the most part, but I'm also probably a little generous in my definition of session mead. Session beers, normally people say 5% ABV at the upper end. I'll probably go 6% on my meads. Uh-huh. But then, when you think about it, my sack strength meads are 14 to 18%, something like that. So it's way more sessionable.
So a session mead would be something under 6%? Is that what you're defining?
That's for me. I think if you really want it, so you could have a couple of them, you probably need to be well under 5 even, because it really hits you bad otherwise.
Well, I know drinking the 15% ones can get you toasted pretty quickly.
Yeah, you don't need a whole pint of most of those.
Yeah. A session mead, I assume, is something like a session beer, right? It's supposed to be something that's light and drinkable and fresh and refreshing, right?
Yeah, that's sort of my take on it. I'd want it to be refreshing, pleasant, probably a nice thing on a hot day after you finish mowing the lawn, maybe.
So a lawnmower mead is what we're shooting for here.
Yeah, I guess that's what it comes down to, except we're not going to use dandelions in it, probably.
Are you, do you make them with a dry finish or a sweet finish? What's the preference?
They're always going to finish dry, so it's how you treat it after the fermentation's over for the most part. I think the big thing is, to me, if you made a traditional mead at the session strength, they tend to get a little boring to me because there's really not a whole lot there. Not much honey to ferment. And so there isn't a whole lot of honey character left over floral flavor wise. So I guess I tend more to fruit or spices or both being added to my session meads to make them interesting. And then, you know, a little sweetness, I think, brings out all of those characteristics better.
So we talked about this last time, but the trick you play with the big meads, of course, is you put enough honey in so that they, you know, that they leave some residual sweetness. Basically, you're playing off the alcohol tolerance of the yeast, right?
Correct. And so to do that with the session mead strength, you're gonna ferment it bone dry because there's hardly a yeast strain around that, you know, can't produce over 5% alcohol, 6%.
Yeah, I think even the beer ones are, you know, at least 9% roughly. Most of them will go to. So if you're starting with only a 5 or 6% gravity of honey, or, you know, roughly in that range, that means it's basically going to ferment down below 1, right?
Yeah, you're going to get 0.995 somewhere to, you know, 0.999, I guess, most of the time.
So it's almost like a wine. The honey basically ferments almost 100% away, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
So it gets pretty dry.
So then how do you get some residual sweetness in it, or how do you get additional flavors in it? I guess, you know, we can talk, we'll talk about flavor in a minute, but
all right,
we'll talk about the other things, but how would you get some residual sweetness in it?
Well, you know, the first tricks you could try, obviously, and they're a little harder to control, but you could try cold crashing the mead to, you know, before the fermentation is over. I actually have a friend that does that with his ciders. You got to get the timing right, you know, because it's a 24-hour process. And if you aren't monitoring at the exact specific gravity you want to start chilling it, and then it's going to take it a while to chill. So it's kind of a guessing game that way. And then you're going to have to keep it cold forever after that until it's gone, because if you warm it up, there's going to be enough yeast in there to the fermentation's going to restart again.
So basically you're cold crashing, you halt the fermentation, and then I guess you keep it near freezing. I mean, how do you cold do you serve it?
Well, I think for a lot of the wine strains, at least, they'll ferment, you know, all the way down to below 50 degrees Fahrenheit. So you got to get it pretty cold and keep it there, or they're going to keep working.
Sounds a little risky to me. It's not something you probably bottle, right?
And you have to get it there before they finish fermenting out what you have. So it's kind of a tough thing for anybody to do, unless you want to run your beer wort chiller and process it that way. And, you know, it just seems like way too much work to even consider doing it to me. But, you know, the option is there to people that want to try it, I guess.
And I know another trick people use is to use chemicals to attempt to kill off the yeast, right?
Yep. Yeah. And we'll talk about that. But the other step that I don't think most home brewers are set up to do is do sterile filtering. You know, you can buy filter pads for your pad filtration system. That'll get you down pretty close to the sterile level, but it's kind of a pain. You're going to have to run multiple stages of pads through your filter, because if you put the sterile ones in first, they're going to plug up quickly.
Because you're talking about something like maybe like a half micron filter that's actually going to filter out all the yeast cells, because the yeast cells are bigger than that, right?
Yeah. So that does, to me, again, I have a filter. I've never tried to get to that level, and I don't think I ever will.
So again, you're halting fermentation, but in this case, by removing the yeast, literally filtering it out, right?
Yeah. Now, at a commercial level, I think there are places that can do that with the, you know, things they call cross flow filters, but they're not cheap.
Mm-hmm. I understand. And you were talking about the multiple stage filters. The reason is because if you put in a half micron filter, for example, it's going to jam up pretty quickly with the yeast, right? So you actually have to have like a 5 micron and then a 1 micron and a half micron.
Down. So now you're going to lose a little mead each time you do this. It's a lot of chances to infect your mead. Just seems like a bad idea to me.
Okay. So we got freezing and filtering. Other options.
So at that point, then it's down to the chemical processes that you could do.
Okay.
So the first thing I'd start with is I'd want to clarify the yeast. You want to get as much yeast as you can out of suspension. Because even if it's down to below one, there's going to be a little yeast left in that fermenter. You want to get as much as you can out of there just so it isn't going to cause you problems later. So whatever your favorite clarifier is, use that.
So you do this during active fermentation? I mean, we're talking about getting some residual sweetness.
It's fermented down to it stopped dropping at a specific gravity.
Okay. Is there option? I just want to ask this question because I've actually had people ask me about it. Are there options to actually stop active fermentation? Can you do it?
Not really, you know, chemically with
not
any.
Reliably.
I guess we didn't talk about the one other thing you could do to stop fermentation. And that would chemically stop it. And that would be to do like the port wine people do, but that's totally at odds with making a session mead, because you could dump enough ethanol in your mead to take the alcohol level to about 20%, and you would shut down the yeast right away.
So fortified mead, but of course, if you fortify your mead, it's no longer sessionable.
Yeah, it's not even close.
Not even close. It's going to be at 15% or more again.
Yeah. I've got to take it up above the yeast tolerance level, so that destroys the whole idea.
Okay.
So as far as I know, those are the only choices on stopping the fermentation.
So beyond that, you're really into what we call back sweetening, right?
Yep. Clarify, stabilize, sorbate, sweeten.
So walk us through that process in some detail. You said first you clarify it. I assume you're using some kind of a clarifier. What's your preferred clarifier?
My go-to is Super Clear, which is two-part. What is it?
It's like Cleosol and something. I can't remember the other one.
Chitosan.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, however you pronounce it, it's derived from shellfish skeletons.
Yeah. So you add that. That's a clarifier. That's going to help at least some of the larger pieces of yeast fall out, right? And sediment.
So you get most of that out. It may not be crystal clear. You'd like it to be pretty close to it, though.
So you do. I mean, this can take several weeks, I assume, even after you finish active fermentation.
I find super clear in a day or two. It's about as clear as it's going to get.
Okay.
It seems to work pretty fast.
So you finish your fermentation, which typically takes a few weeks, right? And then you add the super clear.
Yeah. Well, for a session mead like this, normally I'm going to be down below one in 6 to 7 days.
Makes sense.
It's going to go pretty fast because you're not starting very big.
Mm-hmm.
So now you've got it clear.
Yes.
So the next step is you want to, you know, knock out any of the bacteria that might be in there, including the lactobacillus, because the lacto can absolutely destroy something that you add sorbate to. The sulfate is not going to shut down most brewing yeast strains. At the level you would use to do this, you could shut Saccharomyces brewing strains down with sulfites, but as I understand it, it would be unpalatable at the level you'd have to have the sulfites additions at.
So you're talking about adding sulfites and sorbates, and you're adding the sulfites first, I guess, right?
Right. Yeah. My approach is I sulfate first, and I'll usually add the sorbate the next day.
So it's potassium sulfite you add. And how much? It doesn't take much, right? For maybe a 5-gallon batch.
Follow the directions. You know, the actual dose, you know, if you want to go through it, you can find various charts online. It's a function of the actual pH of the mead and the alcohol level to get the correct dosage.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty straightforward.
Yeah, so the sulfites do help kill off the bacteria, and they also, I think they're an oxygen preserver. They help fight off oxygenation, right?
Correct. Yeah, they have. That is one of the good benefits of them.
Antioxidants, I guess, is what we call
them. Yeah. Yep. And they do naturally occur in pretty much every wine anyway. There's a little bit, I think, produced by the yeast in operation, but not enough for what we're trying to do.
Okay, so you've added some sulfites, and then what's next?
Add some potassium sorbate. Again, you know, the instructions usually give you an amount. The dosage here is again a function of the pH and the alcohol level if you want to do it correctly. Mm-hmm. And so the idea with the sorbate is it's going to stop the yeast that is there from growing, reproducing, i.e. restarting the fermentation. It won't knock out the yeast, but it keeps them from fermenting.
So basically they're not going to reproduce and you're at some point it will stop, right?
Yep.
And then you're left with, again, a fairly dry mead, right?
Right. So now you can add some sweetness to it. You know, and you can use whatever sweetener you want. You could use honey. That would be most appropriate, I think, particularly in a session mead where you didn't start with a lot of honey and you don't have a lot of honey flavor and aroma. Using something like, you know, table sugar, dextrose, want any of those to back sweeten, since they have no character, doesn't seem like it. You know, it's a good idea in a session mead. So I'd stick the honey, the same honey you made the mead with.
Mm-hmm. And then you get some of that flavors. Of course, you're going to get a fresh honey flavor as opposed to a fermented honey flavor out
correct.
Of it, right?
Yeah. And some people claim they can tell the difference. I think that tends to meld in pretty well over a short period of time.
Well, and again, we're talking about a fairly low gravity mead. Yeah, so it ferments dry to start with. How much do you raise it up for a typical session mead? You're not shooting for a sweet mead here.
Yep, I would hope not. I mean, you know, you're going to be starting down at, you know, 1.04 something, probably original gravity.
Yeah, it's like a beer. It's like 1040 with, so or something.
Yeah, you don't want to end it, you know, bring it back up to 1030. That seems kind of strange, but you could.
Be a little sweet at that point.
Yeah, it's kind of, picking the balance you want is all about, you know, personal preference and what other ingredients you put in it.
Right. So you got to have the sweetness balance out, for example, fruits or hops or anything else that you're adding, right? Spices.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I would do a little bench trial in front of me and, you know, measured amounts and glasses and see what level makes the right character pop through rather than doing the whole batch.
And that's a great trick. You take a measured amount of mead, right? And then you slowly add little bits of honey to it until you get to where you want to be, right?
Right. And say, okay, this one's too much. This one's too little. How much in between those is the right spot? And a couple steps you can get there.
And then you kind of scale that up, right?
Correct.
Yeah. So you get up to your finishing gravity. Now you back sweetened your mead. What other things do we do with a session mead? I know many of them are served carbonated, right?
Right. And of course, one of the things you can't do with the stuff we just talked about is bottle condition. So you're not going to be able to bottle condition this mead. Any yeast that's in there is going to be blocked from trying to ferment. And if it did start, would have a big problem in your bottle because you'd have all that back sweet sugar that's going to get fermented as well, and you'd have some glass grenades.
So you don't recommend bottling after back sweetening, right?
Well, you can, but you can't make it sparkling. You could have a still back sweet mead, and that would be fine to bottle. But trying to bottle condition it to get CO2 into it at that point is not a good plan. It won't work from the yeast.
You just stopped all the yeast, and so if you add any more yeast in, you're gonna just create a bottle bomb, right?
Yeah.
Makes sense.
At this point, if you want it sparkling, you're going to have to use forced carbonation.
So you're basically stuck with kegging at that point,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. And do you recommend, is there a particular carbonation level that works? Is it tied to the flavor?
I think that all comes down to balance. I mean, CO2 addition is creating carbonic acid. It's not a strong acid, but it will make a difference in, you know, how it comes across balance-wise. So you could go all the way to, you know, champagne level if you really wanted a little extra, you know, acid in your mead to help balance it out. Kind of a complex question to decide what's right.
Yeah, but I assume you're going to maybe carbonate it similar to a beer in many cases, right?
Yeah, it seems reasonable. But if you think about it, a lot of our traditional go-to summer beverages are still. Lemonade still, iced tea is still, cold water is usually still.
Well, and I enjoy still meads too. I do.
Yeah.
So let's talk about flavorings now. So, do you typically make a session mead to focus just on a particular honey variety, or do you start mixing in spices and fruits?
I find that, something that's this small, there isn't a lot of honey there. So focusing on just the honey seems kind of not something I go for at this low level. So I'm going to add fruit or spices or both. And I'll my typical way to do something like this is I'll make a bigger batch of a mead and then, do several different things to it just because I get variety that way.
Okay. So you might make a 5-gallon batch of mead and then spice it. I guess you're spicing at the end or adding flavors at the end, right?
Correct. And in some cases, if I'm going to do that, you've got to take into account, is this other thing I'm adding going to dilute my mead? If it's a fruit juice, for example, it's going to bring a bunch of water with it. So I need to plan that into my original gravity so that in the end, I end up around the ABV I want after the dilution from the fruit juice.
Right, because most fruits have a lower gravity than even the mead does. Well, certainly the honey does, right?
Right.
So they are going to generally thin things out.
Yeah.
So what kind of fruits and spices do you like?
I think citruses, to me, are just a natural. They seem to work really well with, low gravity things, because they're usually relatively intense fruits, so you don't need a lot. Because again, we're making a session mead, so you probably don't want to be at the 4 to 5 pounds per gallon, of fruits to gallons of the mead, or your gravity is going to be way too far up.
Well, you're not fermenting the fruit either. So, a lot of those flavors, a lot of those lighter fruits that might fade if you fermented them completely are not going to fade in this case, right?
Yep, right. Everything in something you're doing like this is more delicate, lower intensities.
So it's not something you'd use black currants on then, huh?
Well,
too much.
I haven't tried that, but you surely wouldn't want them at the level of the big sack mead. So you'd want it to be a lot lighter.
Have you played with spices much?
It seems like the ones that would fit for these kind of things are the ones that go into, refreshing drinks: mint, ginger, hibiscus, maybe tea,
vanilla. Maybe
that might work. Bananas, things like that.
So kind of a lighter fruity drink, if you will. Think about mixed drinks, maybe.
Yeah, something like that.
Have you tried playing with any hopped meads?
I have, but, I guess the ones I've made were a little too big to be a session mead. Not, I guess by my definition, a session, they're okay. I made one a couple years ago for NHC where I made, in essence, a mead IPA. And so it was starting gravity was in the upper 1040s, fermented dry, back sweetened, dry hopped, and bittered with isohop extract.
So again, are you, you're doing a lot of this at the end, either whether it be spices, hops, or whatever. Do you just flavor it to taste?
Right. Yeah. It's kind of like, what do you think is going to work? And one of the interesting bench test ideas you can do with some of these is you could start with one of your big monster meads and, dilute it down with some water. Pearson Square is a, pretty readily findable thing on Google to figure out how to, drop your ABV from what it is now to somewhere lower, and just add some water in a small glass and, experiment that way. See if the characteristics of this mead would work at low ABV, diluted down. And if it does, you could, make a new batch of that where you scaled all the ingredients down, or you could, do a Just take some RO or distilled water, basically that was sterile, deaerated, and mix it with the appropriate quantity of your big mead and make a whole batch of the small, you know, session mead. So it's kind of your choice.
I assume you're doing the same thing with when you're actually adding spices or fruits or fruit juice or any of those kinds of things. You're probably doing a measured glass, right? Starting with a measured glass kind of mead and add a little bit of fruit juice until it tastes right.
Yeah. And so if you're doing spices, if you prepare a tincture, you know, and then just, you know, measured amounts of the tincture into your glass of measured amount of mead, and you kind of get a pretty good plan of how much is enough.
So get the right balance up front rather than guessing, right?
Right. I mean, there'll be a little change over time because it's going to take a few days for everything to fully pull together once you mix them. But, you know, you're going to be pretty close with a near instant, you know, dosing like that.
I would imagine you do that with hops as well, right? You could probably create a hop, you know, hop tea or something like that and mix it in.
If you're, you can make a hop tea to do that. Otherwise, you know, dry hopping takes time. You can, you know, there are some extracts around that are hop flavor extracts you could play with. I haven't used them, but they are available in the industry. Bitterness is, you know, they're basically iso hopped extracts. So, you know, that one's, you know, they just tell you how many parts per million you need to put into this stuff, and you can, you know, get exactly the IPU level you want if you want to do that one.
And we talked a little bit about actually making the mead, and we talked about, you know, maybe starting around 1040, 1050, somewhere in there. And then are you still using a staggered nutrient addition to complete the fermentation quickly?
Yep. And so if you go with any of the, you know, the online calculators that, you know, tell you how much nutrient you need, you put in your gravity and, you know, your nutrient needs of your yeast strain, and, you know, and they're usually broken down only into low, medium, and high in terms of their needs. And it'll, the calculators will tell you how much nutrient you need. And I spread it out over a few days, just like I would on a big mead.
So you basically treat it the same way if you're using, I don't know, like the Tonsa 2 schedule or Tinosa or whatever it is. And there's several different ones I know.
I'm still using the Fermade K and DAP approach only because I'd bought several kilos of Fermade K and I haven't used it all up.
So you're aerating the must as well before you start, I assume?
I don't think I've ever put oxygen into a mead at the start. You know, I do stir it amazingly aggressively with, you know, the deaerating wand and my variable speed electric drill.
So that's similar. Yeah. I actually have used oxygen on mine. It works great, but,
It's just only, I have to use the stirring anyway to get the honey mixed in. And so it's kind of there, it's in my hand. I just stir for a few more minutes and, you know.
And then of course you degas it, as you go, right? How long do you, when we talk about degassing, why don't you describe that process?
Right, so for degassing, again, it's the deaerating, or, you know, what they call it in the wine world. And, you know, these gadgets are basically some kind of thing you put in a drill and it spins at high speed with a couple paddles and it makes a lot of foam as you're doing this. So you do this at least once a day during the first part of the fermentation to drive out all the carbon dioxide because it's somewhat toxic to the yeast. And also as you're stirring it, you're getting more oxygen in. This is something that when you talk to beer makers or people who are beer makers first, they are just abhorred of the whole idea of stirring this active fermentation. Oh, no, that can't work. That's bad. You know, you're just going to ruin it.
Yeah, I got a little nervous, you know, working with fruit, trying to, you know, I'm pumping all this oxygen in there, but it does work, right?
Yeah, it does work. I mean, there's a whole lot of places doing this, and it didn't come from, you know, nowhere. It's, you know, widespread ideas from the commercial winemaking world. So basically, I'm going to do the deaerating process daily, even a couple times a day if you find yourself in front of your fermenter and have a few minutes, until you get to about 2/3 fermented out. So if you started, say you started at 1040, 2/3 of that, that 40, you know, that's when you want to quit. So that's what, you know, when you get down to, you know, 10, 1.012, somewhere in that range, 1.013, something like that is where you want to stop. So when you 2/3 of the available sugar that you're going to ferment has been used up, you quit, you know, aerating it, because you're getting pretty close to the end and you don't want to oxygenate it once the yeast is done kneading it.
Right. So you only do this degassing process until you get to the 2/3 point, right?
Right.
Yeah.
That's usually about the last time you add nutrients as well.
Okay. So then we talked about, I think most of the rest of the process, you're going to go ahead and clear it at that point, right? Do you transfer right. it at their point as well, or do you?
I usually do. I usually, once it goes clear, particularly if I'm going to be doing other things to it, I want to get it off all that sediment that the clarifying created, because they don't want to mix it back in. Because if you're going to sweeten it with honey, ultimately, you're going to have to do some stirring, and it's really hard to avoid knocking all that sediment back into suspension.
So you do separate it at least once then, right?
Yeah, right. And I have run into cases where adding tinctures from spices will actually cause a haze to occur, and I've had to re-clarify. Not very often, but it has happened.
Interesting. Have you ever had a case where adding spices or anything, kicks off a little bit of fermentation again or not?
No, I have not. Not that I can recall.
But of course, you've already treated it at that point with
sulfites and sulfates. Yeah, it shouldn't be able to do that. You could still drive out some CO2, so you could see some action in that regard, but it's not going to be fermentation. So there's still, you know, some residual CO2 in there, as, you know, Beersmith would show you if you're trying to carbonate it, you know, that take that into account based on temperature. So if you drop the powdered spice, for example, into your meat at that point, it's going to fizz a little bit.
Yeah. Okay. So, and we walked through the finishing process, you know, you add the sulfites, the sorbates, you can add, you can back sweeten it after that and go through the fruits. How long does the whole process take? I mean, one of the advantages of a session meat is it's a lot quicker than making some of these really big meats, right?
Yeah, that's right. So you're probably going to have the specific gravity is going to be down below one, probably 7-8 days at the most you're going to be down there.
Yeah.
And so now you got to clarify it, you know, give it a day or two to do that. Rack it. You can easily, if you're forced carbonated and you want it sparkling, you know, obviously, you could do all this and be done in probably 2 weeks time if you really wanted to.
So really not much longer than making a session beer, huh?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's not something probably that's going to have huge shelf life, because again, it's small.
Yeah, so you're probably not going to be keeping it for years and years and years like some of the big meats.
Yeah, probably not a good idea.
So, but I mean, that compares pretty favorably. You could finish it in maybe 2 to 3 weeks as opposed to, say, 3 months probably for a really big fruit meat, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Some of the big ones I made. So, have you got any final thoughts and tips on making session meads?
Yeah, and it's one I hear every once in a while from people, you know, not just about session meads, is, well, can I just use a sweet mead yeast and then the final gravity will stay above one? You know, and I think I probably made that mistake early on. And so, no, it doesn't work that way.
No, it doesn't.
I mean, those strains are more named sweet versus dry because they're going to have secondary byproducts of the fermentation that work better in a sweet mead versus a dry mead, depending on how they're named. And not that, you know, they're going to ferment everything or not, because everything in a mead usually is 100% fermentable, unless you add some interesting adjunct that isn't all fermentable sugar.
Yeah, I think that's true with all honeys and fruits, both. They basically ferment down to nothing. I mean, grapes, you know, honey, just about anything I can think of, they will ferment well below one. So,
and I think that's why humans really like to eat them.
Yeah, they don't. But unfortunately, that leaves almost no residual sugars, which is why we were talking about the whole back sweetening process, right?
Right.
Yeah. Any other tips on that?
I think that's about it for now.
Well, Steve, I want to take a minute at the end, talk a little bit about your book. I know it's been out for a while now, but you have a book called, I'm reading it right here, The Complete Guide to Meat Making. If we just wonder if you want to say a few words about it.
Oh, sure. It's, let's see, when it came out, almost 4 years ago. So it was actually, the writing was completed, you know, not quite 5 years ago. So there's a big leg in the publication business by the time a book actually hits the shelf, but it's still available. I think the publisher just ordered another print run, so it's still available. It's also available.
What does it have in it?
It's all it's a how-to book. It's not got, you know, lots of technical details. It just explains how to do things. It has a bunch of recipes because my editor felt that would make people like it better. It's got a lot of pictures in it. You know, the photographer did a great job there. So showing you how the process works.
And I want to emphasize too, a lot of people don't know this, but if you have beer making equipment, you probably have just about everything you need to make mead, maybe except for a wine whip or something like that.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Because, you know, there's no hot side in mead making the way pretty much everybody does meads these days. So it's really straightforward. You know, you use most of the same tools you would have used to make your beer.
You're just mixing water and honey.
Yeah, and you don't even need a big stainless steel or whatever pot to fit on your stove, which is the big thing a lot of people run into when trying to get started making beer and trying to get to full-size boil.
Yeah, I do all my meads actually in a plastic bucket.
Same
seems
here.
To work best because you actually need that access in order to get in there and degas it every day, right?
Yeah, and plus it works really good to, you know, push down the fruit to make sure the fruit's staying wet. You know, during the fermentation, I tend to put all the fruit in a big mesh bag just because it makes it easier to get it out of the way when I'm stirring to degas.
And that would be if you're making a bigger mead, not necessarily the session meads we're talking about today, where you had the fruit at the end. But it is an issue. Yeah. Well, Steve, thanks again for coming on the show. Really appreciate you being here.
Great. That was fun.
It's great to have you. Again, my guest was Steve Piatz. Steve was 2008 Mead Maker of the Year. And, of course, you can find his book on Amazon. I should pop it up here. I'll pop it up real quick. The Complete Guide to Mead Making, the Ingredients, Equipment, Processes, and Recipes for Crafting Honey Wine. Steve, it's great to have you. Thanks again.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Well, a big thank you to Steve Piatz for joining me this week. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They have a new Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine podcast, which I encourage you to check out. It features some of the top craft brewery owners and brewmasters discussing brewing techniques and flavors in beer. It's a podcast for those who make and drink great beer. You can find it on iTunes or at beerandbrewing.com/podcast. And also Blickman Engineering, creators of the innovative new BrewVision wireless thermometer. Remotely monitor your brewing system for your iPhone or iPad. Record data, set alerts, and grab recipes directly from the Beersmith cloud. The BrewVision thermometer, another great innovation from BlickmanEngineering.com. And Beersmith 3 is now available for download. Beersmith 3 software adds mead, wine, and cider support, new whirlpool hop options, support for high-altitude brewing, and a whole lot more. Check out Beersmith 3 and get your free 21-day trial today from beersmith.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great brewing week.